This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and to help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. Want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Well, welcome everyone to episode 78 of Metatrex, Trek FM's show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Mike Morrison, and with me, as he always is Zachary Frühling. Zachary, I could not be any more excited than I am right now at this moment, because today we're going to be doing something that we have not done in our previous 77 shows. We're going to talk today about new Star Trek. We are discussing Star Trek Discovery, the first two episodes. I'm excited, Zachary. How are you doing today?
Wait. We talked about Star Trek Beyond. That was new Star Trek. What are you talking about? Don't blow it out of proportion.
This is the first Star Trek. We just sat in the turbo lift, literally. For the first time in 12 years, we are adding, literally as we speak, new canon to the Star Trek franchise. We are expanding our prime universe with this all-new series that takes place 10 years before our beloved TOS, Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. I mean, how can you not get jazzed up about that, to say that we've done that before? We did that for the Kelvin timeline, but not Prime Universe Star Trek.
You know, I think I'm still too close to it. So you have had a chance to rewatch both the first episode and the second episode twice now, you said,
yes.
Right? I have not had a chance to do that. I have watched them each exactly once. And I feel like I'm still very close to it. It's still very new. I'm still processing it. So I think it's a challenge in knowing exactly what this new Star Trek means for us here in the real world, what it means philosophically. I think given that we're just getting to know these characters, we're just getting to know what will become the themes of the show, we're getting teased in a way because the first two episodes of Discovery, not to give away any spoilers, but if you want the spoiler, here it comes, are kind of a red herring, their backstory, their setup for what will become the rest of Star Trek Discovery. So given that, I feel like at best we have kind of a vague, ill-defined, abstract notion of what the themes of the show will become and what its relevance for today is and what its relevance philosophically is. You and I have a long list of potential things that we could draw out of these first two episodes, but they're all, to me, feel like they're really tentative interpretations given we've only seen these first two episodes. We don't really know what's coming. We haven't got to know the characters. We don't know how the storylines are going to tie together. So I feel like our interpretation, while insightful as always, will still be highly speculative.
I think you're exactly right. And that's what I find really fascinating about what they've done here with this. This is kind of a prologue to the actual series that we're going to get beginning next week. I mean, we have Star Trek Discovery, but we didn't really see the Discovery. It wasn't even mentioned within the confines of the first two episodes that we saw. And so what they did was they go back and they tell a backstory. And I've even heard some speculation that, you know, once we get to the actual series next week, you know, we're going to fast forward in time for 3 years or to near the end of the 4 years war with Klingons. So I liken this to what if we would have started Voyager by going back and showing how Tom Paris got messed up with the Maquis and ended up in the New Zealand penal colony. So if you can just imagine Voyager starting there with Tom Paris and the penal colony, before the penal colony, that's kind of what we've gotten here.
I'm actually betting that Saru kind of becomes like Counselor Troi. You know how Counselor Troi in first season of Star Trek The Next Generation basically felt and sensed all of the obvious things? He's going to sense a lot of death coming up, right? It's like, oh, here it is. I'm afraid again. I sense the coming of death. Oh, no.
Yeah, and Burnham calls him on it, you know. She says, you do understand that being afraid of everything means you learn nothing. I mean, even the captain knows that, you know, this is the nature for Kelpians. So I'm interested in exploring, because we get a new alien character, so I'm really interested in that. But it does seem rather odd that this, you know, kind of nervous, paranoid creature is
kind of like Reginald Barkley. It's like, Saru, buddy, why are you even in Starfleet? Get a desk job, man.
Exactly. I mean, this guy should not be in space at all.
I know we're taking pot shots way too early, considering how little of the show we've got. But I have a hunch it will be on point.
But Zachary, what we do here on Metatrex, which is different than any Star Trek podcast out there that I know of, I mean, we talk about Star Trek and we talk about philosophy and philosophy through the lens of Star Trek. Now, we here at Trek FM, we have a dedicated show for Discovery. That is The Edge, which is our newest podcast here on the network. And we want to encourage you to go over and listen to The Edge. They've already dropped their podcast about these first two episodes. So be sure and check those out. Just go to trek.fm and find The Edge under our shows. You can listen to that. We here at Metatrex, we're going to try to focus in on the philosophy, the ethical themes that you're going to find here in these first two episodes. And we might even speculate a little bit about where we think the show might be going in the future. We'll have some fun with that perhaps later in the podcast.
Well, Mike, diving in to start talking about Star Trek Discovery in earnest here, I think the undeniable brute force fact of Star Trek Discovery, the backdrop against which the entire series, at least the first part of the series, we don't know what's going to be happening in a few years if the show lasts that long, but right now the backdrop is one of an impending state of war. We're at the brink of war with the Klingons, maybe even potentially technically at war with the Klingons by the end of the first two episodes. We haven't really discerned that officially. It seems at the end of the episode, it seems like Michael Burnham basically admits to having started a war, you know, and gets punished for it. But, you know, so I guess the question for me is, okay, if that's the backdrop, if this is a state of war and that's supposed to have relevance for today, what relevance does this have to our current geopolitical situation? What's the key sort of core analogy that Discovery is making with the state of the world today? In this, you know, we're no longer in Enterprise land where we're talking about the post 9/11 world. We have, you know, we're on the potential, you know, we have to say we're on the brink of war with North Korea. That's probably overstating it a little bit, but you know, there are threats of lobbing nuclear missiles back and forth between the Korean Peninsula and the mainland United States, right? So that's an impending situation. So I would be interested in drawing out the analogy with the current geopolitical situation, but also maybe just diving into the ethics of war. Here we seem to have a state of mutual preemptive war. To what are essentially superpowers, both being a little paranoid about what the other is going to do, ready to start a preemptive war. And what are the kind of ethics of preemptive war, regardless of the current geopolitical situation with all of its current, you know, contemporary quirks that define it as a unique situation today? In general, what are the ethics of war and preemptive war in particular?
Well, first of all, you should be more optimistic. I mean, you said, even if we have a show in a few years, you should be optimistic, my friend. We're hoping.
Of course we will. The future is hard to see, in all fairness, right? The best we can do is kind of reason by analogy, project based on past events, right? We've got a handful of Star Trek series that have gone 7 seasons, one that's gone 3, one that's gone 4 seasons. So it's hard to discern how long this one will go based on the past, in all fairness. Come on. Don't give me a hard time for that. You know that's true. I speak the truth, man. I'm like Saru. I speak the truth, and I've been bred to sense the coming of cancellations.
Well, let's hope that we get an order for a second season.
I think that's already happening. That's been announced, right? I think. I mean, so not maybe not officially announced, but kind of unofficially discussed.
Yeah, but no official announcement. So we'll see what happens here with this first season. And
don't accuse me of being like Saru. I'm more optimistic than he is.
Fingers crossed. But you know, that's what I find so smart about the writing. Getting back to your point, Zachary, it's what I find so smart about the writing is it's difficult to say, and probably only Brian Fuller, who we know wrote these first couple of episodes. I mean, it literally was you know, his hand that wrote them, and possibly, you know, some of the other writers that are in the writer's room really know what they're drawing from currently to kind of flesh this story out. So I think it was really well written in that I think it's all a matter of perspective. I mean, you can watch this and you can get a number of different interpretations as to what they might be drawing from. I mean, it could be the current political landscape here in the United States. Those that are pushing for something that's more multicultural, something that's more global, and those that are really holding fast to this idea of Americanism, nationalism.
What I really don't know is the timeline of development of Discovery. Like, how much have these stories been defined, say, a year ago versus now? Because now we're living in the Trump era, right? With all of its connotations, for lack of a better word. So what I don't know is to what extent, and like the North Korea thing has become a current situation that was not really, it existed, but it wasn't as amplified as it is under Trump, you know, a year ago. So, you know, are these stories like the Federation versus the Klingon Empire being willing to fight a preemptive war, ready to fight a preemptive war? Is that a direct analogy for the current situation with North Korea? Is this notion of, say, Tukovma, with his, you know, quasi-messianic unification, power, trying to think how to describe this. Like, he's going to unify these houses, right? We have a situation today that is politically diverse, right? People, there isn't political unity. There's political diversity and disagreement and disjointedness. And, you know, you could argue that our country is an analogy for the state of the Klingon Empire that we see in Star Trek Discovery, right? We have warring houses, maybe not in the nobility sense, but at least in the political sense, where we kind of need someone to unify us. And I think a lot of people would identify that. Like, we need to be a little more unified as a country, right? That's what Tukovma is saying. We need to be unified as a people. You know, we need to unify the houses. It's kind of like Braveheart. Unite the clans. So you could argue that the Klingon Empire is an analogy for our political situation in the United States with, you know, a need for a strong leader. Now, there's a negative spin on that. Like there's the kind of the Trumpian kind of leader, the one who's willing to, you know, potentially willing to lob nuclear missiles at another country, right? That's the kind of negative interpretation of a strong leader. And then there's the, you know, kinder, gentler interpretation of a strong leader that can really genuinely unify people and create some sort of solidity amongst people that have these seeming differences. So I don't know if Tukovma, for example, is an analogy for President Trump or not. It feels like that character was in development a bit before these Trumpian events over the last many months. You know, that's my hunch, is that this was probably in development a bit before that. And where if you try to go that direction, you're reading a bit too much into these characters. On the other hand, there are some interesting parallels with today's events. And maybe that's just a happy accident that as world events unfold, you know, what was already in place in terms of story development and character development has now become an even better analogy for the things that are happening in the world today that were hinted at or glimmered at a year ago.
There are a lot of different hermeneutical spins on this, I think that we could take. And again, that really is indicative of smart writing, I think, to flesh a story out that can really be applied to a lot of different situations. I mean, that's always been the thing about Star Trek, I think, that has made it the institution it is, and has allowed it to continue to really speak to our world and the situations in our world and our day-to-day lives for the past 51 years. So, you know, really hats off to Brian Fuller, to the writing team for what we've seen so far. And I'm really hopeful for things to come. But I think that this is really quintessential Star Trek. And I think that this will be relevant 50 years from now, you know, should it endure. I see a lot of similarities between what we saw here in these first two episodes with what we saw in the last iteration of the Kelvin timeline Star Trek. I saw these themes of colonialism, anti-colonialism, if you will. The very first words that are spoken at the beginning of the Vulcan hello, T'Kuvma is saying, "They're coming atom by atom. They will coil around us and take all that we are." And that really sets the tone for at least his pushing back against the Federation. What you call your outermost borders, we call too close to our territory, to Klingon territory. I mean, there's a lot of that anti-colonial, and you know, there were words thrown around like purity. I thought was really fascinating how they were concerned about Klingon purity. They're going to bring us into, you know, to their mess where they, you know, they mix with Andorians and so on and so forth. I thought that was really fascinating.
Those dirty Andorians.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So I think there's a lot for us to kind of dig into and flesh out.
Well, I don't think we're used to seeing Klingons that are very afraid, right? They're almost like, bring on the fight. Especially in The Next Generation and Deep Space Nine, right? We see very warlike, confident Klingons. Here we see Klingons that I think are a little more, I don't know if fearful is exactly the right word, because they're not like cowering in fear. They're ready to go fight. But they don't particularly want a war with the Federation, it sounds like. It sounds like they want the Federation just to go away, and the Federation is encroaching, and they're not happy with it, maybe even afraid of it. And of course, that leads to this situation of potential preemptive war on both sides. But I don't think we're used to seeing Klingons reacting out of fear. And I think that's the strongest analogy that I see with the geopolitical situation today with us in North Korea. We've got us thinking the leader of North Korea is kind of crazy and ready to lob missiles somewhere. You know, from the tweets and the propaganda that are published on the North Korean side, they think President Trump is kind of a crazy person willing to lob missiles over at them, and everyone is afraid of the other side. And it seems like that's a very strong analogy with what we see in Star Trek Discovery so far. But I think that's new, because we're not used to seeing that variety of Klingons that are acting reactively out of fear that way.
See, I disagree with that just a little bit. I think we have seen these type of Klingons before. Star Trek VI, I think we saw types of Klingons. And honestly, I think that this in many ways informs how we got that type of Klingon in Star Trek VI. I think that this tells us something about the inner workings of the Klingon heart and the Klingon mind. Perhaps, Zachary, that bring on the fight mentality is really born out of fear.
I mean, so many things are. I mean, you know, we could go down the rabbit hole of trying to ascribe all of human action to fear. But I think there's a case to be made for that. A great many of our own actions, a great many world events are caused out of fear, reaction to what boils down to being afraid of some outcome, right?
Yeah.
I think that explains a lot of human action, and maybe by extension, Klingon action.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, fear in almost every creature at least on our planet. I don't know about out there in the stars, but on our planet, we talk about the fight or flight sense, and that's, you know, both of those reactions come from the same place, fear, and that fear causes a chemical reaction within the body, the mind and the body, and the reaction is, okay, are we going to fight or are we going to flee? And so I think the Klingon inclination is definitely fight. They're more often than not going to fight. And I think we've learned something already, at least in my mind, about the Klingons and who they are as a species, and how it is that we get a Klingon like we get in Star Trek VI.
I want to return to the Klingons in a minute, because I think we learn a lot that's really interesting about the Klingons here. And that's one of the things that really did gel with me in the first two episodes of Discovery, is this new interpretation of the Klingons, or maybe their backstory in parentheses. It has to be backstory since we're in the same timeline now, right? So it's not a new interpretation. These are the Klingons, and this is the backstory of the Klingons that we know and love, right? So what's fun is you can kind of sense our lack of confidence in knowing exactly how to talk about this. Like, they are a new spin on Klingons, but they're the very same Klingons. They're just Klingons from 100 years ago.
Exactly. Right?
This is the backstory. So there must be a way for it to all come together and make sense. But I think on the surface, there's a lot that doesn't add up with the Klingons that we're used to seeing. So I do want to flesh that out a little bit in a bit. But I also want to dwell a little bit on this state of preemptive war. Do you think that being in a state of mutual preemptive war, where each side is acting out of fear, ready to be the people to fire the first shot, you know, and I think that's true in Discovery, right? The Federation seems willing to, you know, up the ante, and so do the Klingons. Now the Admiral comes along and says, you know, we'd rather talk. We don't want to, you know, if we're talking, we're not shooting at each other. And of course, he ends up dead like 30 seconds later. So much good it did him. But other than that, it seems like there's obviously going to be a warrior. Am I misreading this? I think I'm reading this correctly, that, you know, the Federation is willing to toe the line and defend what they view as their territory. The Klingons view them as encroaching on their territory. And it basically boils down to inevitable conflict.
Well, I agree and I disagree. To say that I agree with that, yeah, I mean, Zhurzhu makes it very clear that, you know, this is Federation territory and retreat is not an option. We are going to hold the line. This territory belongs to us and we're going to defend it. So she comes at it from a defensive position. You know, she's going to stay there and defend that territory, even if it costs the ship and everyone's life. I think the only one who's really thinking about a preemptive strike here is Michael Burnham. And, you know, it's interesting to me because she consults with Sarek. Sarek tells her a story about their first interactions with the Klingons. That's where we get the title for this first episode, Vulcan Hello. I wondered what the heck that meant. And when she said, we got to give them a Vulcan hello, she says, violence brought respect, respect brought peace. And, you know, Michael Burnham is exactly right. That's how you deal with the Klingons. That's a language they understand. But Zhurzhu puts her in a place and says, hey, we're Starfleet. We don't fire first. So I think from the perspective of Starfleet, I don't think they're interested in a preemptive strike. There's no sense of they're going to defend. I think Michael Burnham, rightly so, understands that this is the way we're going to have to deal with the Klingons.
See, this is where I'm a little unclear, right? Is a preemptive strike to me kind of connotes lobbing a missile into someone else's territory? Like if we fired a missile at North Korea or vice versa, that's a preemptive strike, right? That's different from defending your own territory. So yes. Is this skirmish happening in what is literally Federation territory, literally Klingon territory, or a disputed territory where it's not clear at all? And if it's disputed, if it's not clear, if the borders are vague, for lack of a better word, then is preemptive strike even the right terminology? It feels more like a preemptive strike than it's merely defending your own territory. Like if the borders had already been firmly established and the Klingons are invading, that's like, okay, I'm going to stand my ground and defend my territory. That's not happening here either. I get the sense that the borders are disputed at this point, that they're vaguely defined, such that it's more like a preemptive strike and a little bit less like purely defending your own territory in the strict sense.
I think the only ones interested in a preemptive strike are the Klingons, or more specifically, T'Gavma. I think he's interested in a preemptive strike. I don't think the border here is in dispute. I think that there is some fear that... and
I swear I watched it.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
I only watched it once. You watched it twice.
I mean, so. Worf says as much in Deep Space Nine when he talks about the Klingons' need to expand. I mean, we're ahead of the Dominion War, Worf was concerned that the Klingons were going to return to the old ways. He has this conversation with Sisko. He said, I'm afraid that the Klingons are going to return to the old ways. And if they do, you better get ready. I'm paraphrasing here, because, you know, that old mentality is expand or die. that's the mentality of the Klingons, at least from Worf's perspective, and looking back at the old ways. And I think we're looking at these old ways Klingons right now. These Klingons are concerned, I think, and a lot of times we project our own thoughts and our own feelings on to other people. I think the Klingons, or T'Kuvma more specifically, is concerned that the Federation is expanding. And so what you call your outermost borders, we call too close to Klingon territory. So he's going to push back. The frontier is pushing back. And I think he's interested in uniting the clans, uniting these great houses against the Federation to push back before they come in and pollute their Klingon purity.
So a couple of things. In that situation that you described, again, whether it's a preemptive strike or defending one's borders, I don't think it's totally clear which situation we're in based on what we see in the episode. I could see it being interpreted either way. But in that situation, do you feel like a preemptive strike is justified, either from the Federation side or the Klingon side? You know, is this more like a Hobbesian state of nature where it's us versus them, and if it's not, you know, if we don't fire first, they're going to fire at us, so we might as well fire first? Is that a justified reaction, even for the Klingons? Again, you know, Federation tends to be a bit more tentative, a bit more cautious. They tend to say, we don't fire first, you know, but in that brink of war situation, is that preemptive strike? Again, in parentheses, maybe that's not a 100% accurate description of what's going on in the episode. I don't think it's out in left field, though. Is that a justified reaction? Does it essentially boil down to us versus them at that point? Or is the captain justified in saying, no, we need to not fire first, hold to our principles? But really, what's going to happen is the Klingons are going to come in full force at that point, right? So it seems like a Pyrrhic victory. Like we can hold to our principles, but if the Klingons come in an armada and wipe us out, much good it does us, right? So I am sympathetic with the Klingons' mindset here. It's us versus them, and so we're going to strike first. I think that's a natural reaction if it is a genuine us versus them situation.
I think the Klingons have already struck. What brought these two forces to this binary system is the fact that the Klingons have destroyed a relay, a communications relay. But
that's like saying a Klingon stepped on my cell phone. That's not a first strike. Come on.
Well, I don't know, because
I say that half jokingly, but that's not like wiping out a planet. That's like we took out a communications satellite, right? That there's a difference in scale there.
I think that T'Kuvma lured them there, and they speculate that as the bridge crew kind of has this conversation, Saru and Michael Burnham and the captain have this conversation, you know, and they're speculating as to what's happened to this communications relay. And the conclusion is that this communications relay was sabotaged. And the speculation is that it was sabotaged to lure them there. And so there they are. And for what purpose? An actual preemptive strike.
I presume you picked up on the Sun Tzu reference inside the episode, the quote, all warfare is based on deception, and when you're able to attack, you must seem unable. I thought one of the most interesting aspects of this, again, I don't really have the question to whether preemptive war is justified. That's purely a speculative question on my end. I don't think I have a great answer to that. But I do appreciate the depiction of the gamesmanship of war in this situation, right? The Klingons are being deceptive, luring the Federation in. They're going to try to, you know, react by, you know, taking this explosive device and having the Klingons, you know, retrieve it with their dead. And, you know, this kind of the gamesmanship of war is a fascinating game. It's like one big chess game unfolding.
Yeah. I, by the way, I love the Sun Tzu reference in there. You know, Sun Tzu was a pre-modern age general who gave us probably the most widely read book on war there is, and that is The Art of War. So I love that they kind of stuck that in there.
It essentially boils down to don't lose the war, to put it, you know, do what you have to do.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
No, it's a little bit Machiavellian. It's a little bit of Sun Tzu. It's, you know, there's some game theory involved here. Like this, you know, if everyone's trying to deceive everyone else, what is the correct course of action if you can't rely on what the enemy is doing before your eyes? If there's inherent deception in what the enemy is ostensibly doing, how does that affect your own reactions and what should you do? Because you can really go down the, like Data does, like, we know that they know that we know that they know that we know that they know, right? You can overanalyze this gamesmanship of war. At a certain point, you just, someone has to decide, am I going to shoot or not?
Well, to me, that felt so very original series. I mean, I really felt at moments like I was watching something that really was spawned out of the original series, because that's the type of scenarios that we got so many times in the original, and the Next Generation did it well too. But
trying to guess what the Romulans are doing.
Yeah, they
did that all the time in the Next Generation.
Exactly. Except instead of Romulans, we're dealing with the Klingons again.
Doesn't Riker say that it's always a game of chess with them?
It's always a game of chess with them. Absolutely.
That's what we're seeing here with the Klingons. It's a game of chess with them.
Right? And a great game of chess it is. I mean, these two great leaders, and I think T'Kuvma is a great leader. I think that although, you know, we only get two episodes with her, I think Captain Georgiou is a great leader.
You don't think T'Kuvma is like a great cult leader? No, I'm serious. I think of T'Kuvma as being kind of like a Klingon messianic restorationist figure. Like, he sees that Klingons have devolved into warring houses, 24 warring houses that don't agree. Everyone's focused selfishly on his or her own honor, his or her own house, and he wants to unify them. It's like, come with me, follow me, and drink the Kool-Aid. I really feel like he is a great leader, but not maybe in the most positive sense. It strikes me as very kind of culty restorationist-y.
I think you're right on the money. And Commander Burnham refers to him as a Klingon messiah, and even to
a false messiah. Right? He's not Kalis, like the Klingon's actual
but
messiah.
But he does say that Kalis is reborn in him.
Just like a great many cult leaders,
sure,
do.
Oh, absolutely.
Jesus is born again in me, right?
Yes,
that's a common refrain. It's like, I am Jesus reincarnated. Okay, you're a cult leader. Like, second someone says that's like, you're a cult leader, right? And that's essentially what T'Kuvma is doing. He's essentially the Kalis cult leader.
And what we get, Zachary, at the end of Battle at the Binary Stars is a martyr for the Klingons to rally around.
Yeah, you're right, but that's kind of despite Michael Berman's admonition not to make him a martyr.
Yeah, exactly. But they made him a martyr. She made him a martyr.
Well, we don't know how it's going to unfold, right? We don't really know, but presumably he's going to be martyr-like.
Yeah. It's fascinating to me that the intention was to take him prisoner, and, you know, he kills Captain Georgiou, and Michael Burnham puts the kill shot on him.
So it's
tragic. It's not. And how indicative is that of those types of scenarios? How many times do we turn on the news and we find out that a particular operation, military operation that we've tried to execute didn't go the way we had planned, or a training maneuver didn't go the way it was planned and somebody got hurt, somebody got killed? I mean, these things happen in the real world, and I'm really glad to see that not-so-neat kind of storytelling in the Star Trek universe. I mean, for so long, Zachary, I feel like storytelling within the Star Trek universe has been neat and pressed and clean and...
I don't know. Look at all those red shirts that died in the original series. No, I know I keep pressing this tenuous analogy with our current political situation, mm-hmm. but I do want to delve into it because this is where I think the rubber meets the road. We live in a world that has problems, and what does Star Trek have to say about them? So I keep wanting to ask that question. I think the situation we see the Klingons in is interesting. They were once more noble than they're depicted in at the beginning of Star Trek Discovery. They've devolved. They're what are warring houses now. Some sort of nobility and aristocracy don't really, again, they're trying to flesh out this notion of aristocracy, but it's clear that the Klingons have kind of devolved from a former glory mm-hmm. in some way. And T'Kuvma is trying to reunite them, reinvigorate them, return them to their former glory, you know, call upon the glory of Kales reincarnated in himself, whatever that means, and restore the Klingon, the height of Klingon civilization, for lack of a better word. So now let's look at the United States. You know, we were fairly unified coming out of World War II. Over the many decades that followed, we kind of fragmented into, at least bifurcated into, two opposing political camps. There's a culture associated with each of those political camps that each side does not recognize about the other. And you could argue that we're in a similar situation. We've maybe have reached a peak in the 20th century in some way. We are now, I don't want to say we're in a state of decline, but we're not as unified as we once were. And Tecumseh, by analogy, is the unifying force that will reunite everyone. But he's more like a cult leader, as we just described, right? Is there something of an anti-democratic, I don't want to say a claim, because I don't think anyone would accuse the creators of Star Trek Discovery of being anti-democratic, I think. But is there a potential anti-democratic argument to be made here that what we need to unify people is not a return to our pure democratic roots, but a strong unifying figure that can overcome these... this cultural bifurcation that seems to have taken place within the United States. I think, you know, people on the right wing do not understand the way the left wing thinks, they, you know, and vice versa. There are two very different spheres of worldviews, all within our ostensible democratic country, you know. So is there an analogy to be made there, or is that really reaching? And if that's a genuine analogy, what does the fact that it takes a, you know, a cult leader like Tecumseh to unify this fragmentation that's occurred in the Klingon Empire, what does that say about us? You know, arguably you can say, again, this is a bit, I'm going to run the risk of being a little uncharitable, the charismatic leader in the form of a president like Donald Trump that can get people riled up. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a danger of that being interpreted as a culty kind of messianic figure. And I don't know if people actually view Donald Trump as that way, but I think you could take this really negative spin and say that's exactly what's happening here in the United States. We have this leader that is getting everyone riled up, rallied around a cause. And maybe he's causing more bifurcation than actually unifying. But I guess the danger that I see is that the bifurcation and the fragmentation here in our country could... it could lead to a quasi-messianic figure using that situation for his or her own power purposes.
Sure. And Sarek says as much in the episode. He says, great unifiers, few and far between, but they do come. And he says, often such leaders will need a profound cause for their followers to rally around. And that's absolutely right. I mean, we've seen that in our own history. Over the course of our own history, we've seen great unifiers come, and some of those unifiers, Zachary, history looks favorably upon. Other unifiers, and I'm thinking of you know, the Adolf Hitlers. Adolf Hitler was that kind of great unifier.
Absolutely, that's a great example.
He rose out of the ashes of World War I, and you know, the disgraced German nation under the Kaiser, and he rose up and he unified the nation. And, you know, that profound cause that he got his entire country to rally around, and they practically consumed the entirety of Europe, you know, over the course of, you know, the 1930s and early 1940s, and, you know, until Churchill drew the line in the sand and put a stop to it. But Tecumseh is much the same way. I mean, Tecumseh said there's no honor without unity. There is no home for any of us unless it is shared by all. That's a unifying statement. He's appealing to the Klingon sense of honor, and he's saying, hey, we're not going to have the honor that we deserve, that our race deserves, until we're unified, until we all come together and push back against the colonialism of the Federation.
But this concern for Klingon purity is dangerous. You know, it's the same kind of rhetoric that the Germans used about German purity and the alt-right people are using about, you know, quote-unquote white purity here in the United States.
But not to the Klingons. But not to the Klingons. I mean, you and I look at it
that. Are you defending Klingon purity?
No. I'm just saying you... I mean, you and I can look at it that way, but to the Klingons,
Yeah, sure. Well, to the Germans, it looked that way. To the alt-right, it looks that way. To the Klingons, it looks that way. I guess that the fact that people don't see their own racism in their own face. You know, these are Klingons being racist.
Sure.
Like Klingon purity, German purity, alt-right white purity. It's the same old thing.
Yes, it is.
But I do think our current situation is analogous to the Klingons in an interesting way. We're fragmented like the Klingon Empire is fragmented. So I want to kind of ask this fundamental question of who exactly is the analogy for us today. Are we more like the Klingons in Star Trek Discovery because of our fragmentation, or are we more like the Federation trying to hold to our values in the face of fear and in the face of impending, you know, all the negative things we see in the world today? We know which is the analogy for us, maybe both of them, but sadly, I feel like it's a little closer to the Klingons. And I think that's a sad commentary on us today, but
that's fascinating because, Zachary, quite frankly, I see it as a 50-50 kind of proposition. And if you frame this in, you know, this kind of debate over multiculturalism versus nationalism, I think here in the United States, we're divided. I think it's 50-50. I think we quite literally have 50% of our nation that very much would like to emerge into a global, multicultural, kind of no borders sort of world. I think that's very
arguably
much
arguably the world we see in Star Trek.
The world we see in Star Trek, absolutely.
Right.
But then you have, and I do believe it's about 50% that are pushing back saying, you know, no, it means something to be an American, and you know, Americans died for the rights that we have, and so there's this 50-50 divide. You see it maybe a little more 60-40, I don't know, but I see it as 50-50, and I think that is very analogous. I think rather what we see in these first two episodes is very analogous to that.
I can totally picture T'Kuvma screaming, "Build the wall, build the wall, build the wall." Right? This is not a leap.
We're going to build a wall.
Exactly. We're going to make the Federation pay for it.
How do you say build a wall in Klingon?
We're going to make Starfleet pay for it.
How do you say wall in Klingon?
Well, I know I was pretty bold in saying the Klingons are racist now. You know, but really, this is interesting because we did kind of learn that they're racist in at least two senses, right? We've got the racism against the encroaching Federation with all of its dirty Andorians and dirty Vulcans and dirty humans, right? And then we have racism within the Klingons, right? We have Klingons with different color skin now. You know, these different houses have a slightly different look to them. They're not as uniform as what we saw in Star Trek The Next Generation and Deep Space Nine and whatnot, right? Mm-hmm. So we get some variation. So we even see T'Kuvma basically saying, you know, you, Mr. Pale-faced Klingon, even though you've got this disadvantage of your skin color, you have a heart of purity and Klingon honor, and you can join our cause, even though, despite your disadvantage, as the Vulcan Science Academy would have said to Spock. So, you know, we see, I think this is interesting, because I think what we see here is the same kind of shtick that was being done way back in the original series episode, Let That Be Your Last Battlefield, this play on white versus black and different skin colors and how ridiculous it looks, being played out now with Klingons. Now we have Klingons with different skin colors, and we are learning that, you know, they are a little bit racist on the inside, and that looks ridiculous from the outside. But despite that, they really are all the same, and this pale-skinned Klingon can have a heart of a Klingon, just like the other darker-skinned, you know, Klingons that have a heart of a Klingon. Again, we don't really know where it's going to go. It was just a glimpse of it, but it definitely to me had shades of that very famous episode from the original series with the aliens with faces that were half black and half white, and some of them were reversed and they were all racist, and from our human standpoint it looked remarkably ridiculous. I think that's what's going on here to some degree, right? We have Klingons with different color skin. You know, there's a question of their, you know, Klingon purity of heart and how that relates to their skin color in these warring houses that are not all uniform looking anymore. And I think it's a very interesting commentary on racism. Again, we don't really know where it's going to go because we just got a tease of it, but I think it's not a reach to say that that's a thread inside this portrayal of the Klingons.
Well, I think there's a really interesting visual there, Zachary, in the episode when T'Kuvma comes very close, almost nose to nose with the albino Volk. He says to him, you know, something to the effect of, you know, some would look at you as nature's mistake. He said, but I see a mirror, and in that mirror, I see myself.
What I feel like I don't know is how to interpret this, right? There's this thread of Klingons that now have, they're kind of racist and fearful of the encroaching Federation. There's kind of some sort of internal variation / racism amongst the Klingons. So what? I mean, clearly that's an analogy for us today as we're screaming, build a wall, keep those Mexicans out, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's such a blatant analogy. And again, was that something that was intentional or is that accidental? I think that's a really interesting question because I have a feeling timeline wise, again, this is shooting from the hip. I don't really know. I haven't looked up the dates when the stories were written, whatnot, but when these stories were written, we were probably around election time or a little before, a little after election time last year, right? You know, leading into production of the actual show. You know, that's when we got this build a wall mm-hmm. rhetoric, right? So I feel like that's a pretty plausible, intentional analogy. Again, we're playing the hermeneutics game, trying to guess what the creator's yes. intention was. But I feel like it's not a total reach, given what was going on when these stories were likely being written. Now, the analogy with North Korea, I find a little more tenuous because, you know, that's a later development here. You know, the show was already kind of in development and that became part of the rhetoric. But I think the inherent racism behind build a wall is a, pardon the expression, pale-faced metaphor for what's going on in today's world. I think it's such an obvious connection, I think.
Yeah, and I don't disagree, but you're right. I mean, we could sit here and play the hermeneutics game all day. And again, I think this is what's really indicative of just what I think is brilliant writing. I think 50 years from now, we'll be able to look at something in our world and say, okay, that episode of Star Trek Discovery is very analogous of that. I think it points to the same types of problems. And Zachary, I hope that we don't have these types of problems in 50 years. But, you know, frankly, we can look back 50 years. We had these problems with racism in our country. It was the 1960s. We were, you know, really just in the midst of and emerging from the civil rights movement of the 1960s when we got the first iteration of Star Trek on television. And we've had a couple of periods of time over the course of, you know, we go to the 1980s, we can look at, you know, really the New World Order kind of movement that was going on, where we were really starting to talk about, you know, a global multicultural society. And, you know, we've had some pushback against that. And so, you know, here we are, we've got the same old problem recycled, regurgitated. I think 50 years from now, there'll be something that we'll be able to say, okay, you know, that Discovery show, that's very analogous for what we're seeing in our world now.
Okay, that's an interesting point, because I feel like if a show is being genuinely metaphorical or is a genuine analog for what's happening in the real world, if, in other words, if it's on point, right, it shouldn't have to wait 50 years to see its relevance. And I feel like I also think, in parentheses, it's kind of a truism that there are a lot of racists that don't think of themselves as racist. They sure. don't understand that there's even a problem to be solved, right? They just don't view the
world
that way.
And that was my point about the Klingons earlier.
Way. So, you know, in the 1960s with the original series, you had commentary on the Cold War and you had commentary on racism and gender politics and a bunch of things, right? Some people were like, wow, that's on the nose. I totally get the point you're trying to make, Gene Roddenberry. And some people are like, I don't get it. I'm not racist, right? What's with all these different color faces? That, you know, like the fact that it could fly by the censors. And I really feel like it probably fell on a lot of people's deaf ears because they just don't view the world in that way. They don't view themselves as being a problem to be solved. And I feel like that's the situation here today. Like if you think of it in these terms, if you think this is a problem to be solved, if you think that build a wall is inherently kind of racist, then you're going to go, what an on-point kind of message this is, right? The Klingons are shouting, build a wall, and they're kind of racist too. And, you know, this dude T'Kuvma is kind of like Donald Trump. He's a charismatic figure. And, you know, okay, so you can draw all these analogies. But if you are on the other side of the fence, pardon the pun, and you're one of these people that are, say you're an alt-right person who doesn't view yourself as racist, right? You don't see the problem, so you don't see the commentary, and those people I feel like aren't going to get it. They might have to wait a while for the message to become clear. I think the commentary that the original series gave on the situation in the 60s is so much clearer to so many more people now than it was 50 years ago. Although sure. to a large number of people, it was very on point in the moment, but not for everyone.
Right.
And I feel like that's probably what's going to happen with Discovery. I feel like there's a lot of really interesting on the nose commentary here that if you don't think of these things as problems in the world to be solved, you're going to go, I don't get what this Star Trek Discovery thing is all about. Right? I don't understand these Klingons, right? Because, you know, I fundamentally you have to say, there's a problem here to be able to solve it. If you don't see that there's a problem, then you're not going to see the relevance. And maybe in 50 years, it might become clear and maybe it never will. But I feel like a good, you know, a message that is relevant and on point should not be so cryptic that you have to wait 50 years to see it. And I think it's a sign of good writing that we can debate which is what's a metaphor for what and what's mm-hmm. the real message here. Again, we're too close to it to be able to say for sure, you know, in another month, maybe we'll have more refined thoughts about this.
Yes.
But I feel like if we have to wait 50 years, then it's not on point enough.
Yeah. And Zachary, it occurs to me that really is why so far what we've been given in these first two episodes is so very Star Trek.
Well, that's the thing. I think there's the fear that with modern storytelling approaches, you know, the modern visuals and the modern way of setting up a story, modern cuts, modern visual effects, you know, kind of the 21st century spin on Star Trek, that it will lose its relevance. I don't think there's a danger of that. I mean, we have a list of, you know, 20 things that Star Trek Discovery in its first two episodes could be a metaphor for here in the real world. And I feel like, you know, again, I don't want to be mean to anyone, but I feel like if you're not getting some of that, you're missing what Star Trek, already missing after two episodes, what Star Trek Discovery is all about, right? So if you're listening to this and you're worried about Star Trek, you know, think about all of the problems in the world and all of the things you're seeing on screen and how, and try to draw these lines of connection. You'll see this is a very intelligently written show. Again, it's different than the show I would make. And I've said this all along. Like when I heard it was going to be a prequel, I'm kind of like, oh, a prequel. Okay. I wouldn't do that. And that's still kind of my gut reaction. Maybe like I would like to, I'm always a forward looking person. I would not have done a prequel. I would have gone forward a little bit, but I do feel like the prequel situation with the potential war with the Klingons here is a good analogy for our potential war with North Korea. And so it's incredibly on point. And it's because of that on pointness, you go, God, don't worry about Star Trek losing its soul, right? You know, Star Trek has done social commentary and political commentary all along. And here we've got a fairly long list of things that, you know, Star Trek Discovery already could be a metaphor for here in the real world. So I hope everyone is trying to view Star Trek Discovery in those terms and not purely in terms of pew, 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 you know, fire the phasers mm-hmm. terms.
And Zachary, I'm exactly the opposite. I'm to some degree glad that we didn't get something going even further out, only because I've always appreciated the fact that we're looking forward into the future, but not so far forward into the future that it's unreachable. And so, you know, we're 10 years before Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. We're a generation removed from Enterprise, and so for me, this is perfect. I mean, it really is. It really is perfect. And you have all of these beautiful little touchstones. And I don't want to get away from the philosophical conversation, but you know, I feel like that there are touchstones there that fans can say, "Oh, listen to the sounds on the bridge. Oh, look at that phaser. Oh, look at that communicator."
Oh, it's very familiar.
What's that?
In fact, I mentioned while I didn't have a chance to watch both episodes twice, what I did do before I started recording the podcast today was I actually put the audio for the second episode on the background. We're in the 21st century. We're living in the future. I whipped out my mobile device and I hit play on my CBS All Access and I couldn't watch it because I was working, but I set it there on my desk and I listened to the episode again. And it's amazing how much like the original series it actually sounds when you're just listening to the audio and not paying attention to the modern visuals. But for me, I think you and I have slightly different intuitions here. What one of the core things that I enjoy about Star Trek in general, both about the original series and especially in 1990 Star Trek and to some degree in Enterprise, and we haven't seen much of Discovery yet, so we don't really know, right? But one of the things I like is the push into the unknown, not necessarily the political unknown, right? Because that's what's going on here so far. We've got the political unknown. We've pushed out, and now the Klingons are there, and we've got a political situation, and that is analogous to our real world situation. Here in the real world, we live in a world of politics, right? We don't live in a world of sort of pure exploration. But I like the kind of pure exploration speculative elements of Star Trek. Like if you genuinely go out into the unknown to a strange new world or some strange scientific phenomenon, what's that going to say about science? What's it going to say about abstract ideas? What's that going to say about metaphysics? You know, these kinds of more abstract issues that are not so concrete and political. I like those things about Star Trek. I always have. I think that's part of its science fiction roots. I think there's a danger of losing its science fiction roots a little bit if we focus purely on politics. So I think that's a danger. We don't know how Star Trek Discovery is going to unfold. And you know, this was partly my philosophical temperament. That's why those things are why I became a philosopher. I didn't become a philosopher because of political philosophy. And some people do. Some people really get attracted to philosophy in general out of the political philosophy and out of these concrete ethical situations and applied ethics. And that's not me. That's other people. If you're one of those, we love you, but that's not me. So I really get off on the more abstract areas of philosophy. And I like that about Star Trek, that Star Trek draws attention to those things. And I think there's the more relevance we have politically, the more there is a danger of losing our abstract cognitive faculties as we think about what Star Trek says about philosophy.
Yeah, I just appreciate these touchstones. And I think that we're surrounded. One of the characters, he's injured. He's supposed to go to sick bay. He stumbles into the brig, and he,
this isn't sick bay.
And he says something that sounds very familiar. You know, basically he says, you know, what are we doing? We're Starfleet. We're supposed to be explorers. So why are we fighting? That sounds very familiar to me. Hello, Jonathan Archer. that was some of his own struggle, and I'm glad they bring that into Discovery, because as an Enterprise fan, that's a touchstone. As a original series fan, that's a touchstone. So I think there's some familiar touchstones there for fans and for the new fans that have come in. And I know I've gotten completely away from the philosophical discussion. I promise we'll get back to it. But for the new fans who came to Star Trek through the Kelvin timeline, I think they should
be... I feel like it'll be very familiar.
Yeah, they should be very pleased, because there were a lot of things that looked very familiar. I mean, those were J.J. Abrams lens flares if I ever saw them.
Don't make fun of the lens flares.
No, I'm not. I'm just saying that it looked and felt very familiar.
But okay, I think you make an interesting point. The character that wants to be an explorer, but he's forced to fight a war, is an interesting character. Because that's essentially the situation I've described. I want to be a consciousness in a ball of light, talking about abstract philosophy, right? I don't want to be talking about crappy politics here in the real world. And so many times our loftiest goals are dragged down into the minutiae of the real world. And philosophers hate that. And I think that's the situation that a sort of pure explorer would be in. I want to be an explorer exploring the unknown. I don't want to fight a war with the Klingons, right? That's essentially what I've just described. I want to, you know, talk about philosophy and you know, the many interesting things that go along with it. I don't want to talk about war with North Korea, right? That's not what I want to talk about. But so often we're forced to talk about those things because that's the real world. And that's where we see the biggest danger for ourselves. And maybe where we see some of our noblest, you know, if we react well in a crisis situation, that's where we see human beings at their noblest at the same time. So there's something to the fact that, you know, when you're in a crisis like that, you can see the best of humanity at the same time. But that's not what we want to do. We don't want to be fighting wars. We want to be explorers.
Yeah, and I mean, Connor said we're explorers, not soldiers. Unfortunately, it gets sucked into the vacuum of space. And
right, but that's what's happening here on Metatrex with me. I don't want to talk about war with North Korea. I want to talk about abstract philosophy, but we're constantly forced to talk about war with North Korea because that's what's happening in the real world and that's politically what's relevant. But, you know, that doesn't capture our loftiest nature as human beings, I think.
But how rare a thing to face one's own demons, Zachary. This inner conflict. Zachary, all kidding aside, I think that's a great segue into talking about what we presume it will be our main character here for Star Trek Discovery, and that is the character of Michael Burnham, who is having an inner conflict. She is a human raised on Vulcan. She is the ward of Sarek, the father of Spock. And so we have a character who is living in one world, rooted in another, and she is a little ball of conflict.
It's interesting because in Michael Burnham, we see some things we've talked about previously on Metatrex, right? She is essentially disobeyed orders. She's mutinied on her own ship, yes. Right? She's knocked out the captain and she's going to go, you know, commandeer the ship to do what she thinks is right. That's a very, you know, we've seen countless characters in Star Trek do that.
But she's suffering some serious consequences here, Zachary, which is something I don't think
we've... Yeah, it's not the reset button.
Yeah, I don't think we've really seen consequences like this in the Star Trek universe.
Well, consequences until episode 3 when she ends up on a nice shiny new ship again, right? This is the Voyager reset button all over again. Consequences, my foot.
But she's on a new ship, but let me tell you, she is not welcome. I mean, that much is clear from the little snippets that we've gotten to see.
She'll have to earn it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So one thing that's interesting about Michael Burnham is that she's been traumatized. Her parents were killed by Klingons, and that is a traumatic experience. And my own experience in life and my experience with other people who have experience with trauma is that trauma can lead to an influence, for better or worse, oftentimes worse, on decision-making, mm-hmm. right? And here we see, I think, a direct connection between her traumatic experience, her wacky upbringing, being raised as a Vulcan, essentially, and her decision-making in the here and now. And so there's kind of this causal traumatic chain from her early experience in life to today. And I don't know enough about the psychology, but I certainly know there's an effect of, you know, a causal link between trauma and what you do in the here and now.
But Zachary, I'm going to defend her just a little bit. You described her decision-making as something that sounded faulty as a result of her trauma. But I disagree to some extent. And now, don't get me wrong, I think the decision to incapacitate her captain was a bad decision. And
specious at best.
She did that in the heat of the moment. I think that was something that she hadn't planned on. I don't think it was anything premeditated. But her decision-making, apart from that, and this is really one of the things that I find strange about this episode. Up until this point, it's very clear that Captain Georgiou respects her, values her counsel, trusts her implicitly. She has, and she says as much, you know, I'm gonna ask you to take a look at the last 7 years of service that I've given you and go forward with the plan that I've presented. She's got a good plan. She sought counsel. She's looking at historical evidence and she's given a plan. Now that plan got rejected and she's got to accept that and move on. But
well, she makes a very Vulcan
decision making.
Makes a very Vulcan decision though. Her Vulcan decision was to prioritize the needs of the many over the needs of the few. And, you know, she basically says, I thought it was more important to save everyone's lives than to stand on principle.
I'm trying to save you. I'm trying to save all of you.
Right. And that sounds like a Vulcan, needs of the many. You know, sure. We've heard that line before.
Sure. And, you know, she's absolutely right about the Klingon. She says the ideal outcome for any Klingon interaction is battle. They're relentlessly hostile. It's in their nature.
She also says that she's not clear whether that decision was based in logic or emotion or both, and she doesn't really know. Remember, she's not Vulcan. She's a mm-hmm. human, raised as a Vulcan, essentially, right? So, but I think what is plausible is that there is this emotional undercurrent to her that's driving her decision, that she's going to, you know, as a result of her Vulcan upbringing, try to justify and couch in terms of logical decision making. Really, it's all driven by emotion. I think that's a totally plausible interpretation of what I saw.
Well, she has this this long distance call with Sarek. You know, Sarek, you know.
Well, they have this long distance mind meld and the long distance call.
Yeah, yeah, they have
had both.
Yeah, they have both. But during the long distance call, she, you know, she basically says, you know, I'm happy to see you. And Sarek, which James Frayn, I think does this so well. This was written so well and acted so well. He says, so many years and you still allow emotional considerations to impede your logic. And I love her follow-up to it. She says, they inform my logic. She's found this really interesting balance between her emotions, which, by the way, are to some degree influenced by her trauma, and her logic. She's found this really interesting balance. I think when we meet Michael Burnham, yeah, she's conflicted to some degree, but I think she's overall a very balanced individual. But in the heat of having her recommendation shot down, she really does what Spock does in Star Trek II, except she does it to her captain. Whereas Spock knocks out McCoy so he can save the ship. She incapacitates her captain so she can go out and fire on the Klingons. I think there are some similarities, but there are some differences, and I think it's really interesting when you look at it from that perspective as a fan.
I'm glad you thought to mention this line from the episode that emotions don't impede logic, they inform logic. Because so many times in Star Trek, especially with Vulcans, we see this conflict between logic and emotions. And in Spock, in the original series, we see this inner conflict writ large. Mm-hmm. But really, if you're going to reason well, like say what she does with the brig, right? She's going to reason her way out of the brig by setting up this deduction problem for the computer to solve, and you know, realize that there's only one inescapable conclusion for her to get.
I love that. Wasn't that Captain Kirk?
Well, sort of, but being able to reason well deductively, like to start with information you already know, mm-hmm. and deduce further things that you don't know yet that you're going to learn in the course of your deduction, that depends on having as accurate, reliable information as possible as the premises from your deduction, right? So if this emotional background of all the people around her and herself, this emotional knowledge that she has access to as a human, as opposed to being a genuine Vulcan with radically repressed emotion, you know, if that creates better insight, more accurate information from which you use logic to deduce the right course of action, then I think she's totally justified in saying, no, emotions are yet like another window into the world in addition to my other senses, right? I've got taste and I've got touch and I've got my sense of smell and all my five senses, but I also have my emotional perception of the world around mm-hmm. me. And if that is a sense, like a sixth sense, for lack of a better word, right? That's another window into the world that it provides accurate, reliable information from which I can use my quasi-Vulcan logic to, you know, choose the right course of action, then so much the better. I think that's a really interesting take on the role of emotions as it relates to the Vulcan worldview that we haven't quite seen put in those terms in Star Trek before. I think that's really, really an interesting slant on it.
Yeah. And there's some great, great conversations around this idea of balancing logic and emotion. And I think we're going to see more of that as we move along. I think that's going to be a recurring theme, at least throughout this season. When we get one of these little flashback scenes, the young Michael Burnham is basically having a meltdown during a quiz or a test, and she's crying. This young girl is crying, and she apologizes to Sarek. Sarek says to her, when emotion brings us ghosts from the past, only logic can root us in the present. We get these great little conversations. Sarek challenges her, you know, talking about how rare it is to meet one's own demons in the flesh. So he recognizes that inner conflict, and he kind of confronts her, you know, with it to deal with it. And I like that. I think we're going to see more of that, this finding a balance between logic and emotion. I think that it's something that we have seen in the abstract in other iterations of Trek. I think we're going to see it really laid out in a very plain, simple way throughout Discovery.
Well, I think when we've seen Sarek in the past, he barely recognizes the existence of emotion, right? Mm-hmm. Here, I think we see a much stronger willingness to recognize that emotion is at least a thing, if not for Vulcans, then for Michael Burnham. You know, he's kind of thinking of these terms. It's a brute force fact of reality that you can't ignore, right? Vulcans try, they repress it. They do all these countermeasures against emotional countermeasures. I love it. Vulcans do emotional countermeasures, for lack of a better term. But here we at least see that he recognizes that emotion exists, that there is this internal struggle, and denying that is not wise. And I think that's different from the Sarek we've seen before. It's more nuanced, it's more subtle, but it doesn't really jive with Sarek as we know him, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. But as you and I talked in the Turbo Lift before we got started, I think that we have an opportunity here to learn some things about Sarek. I think perhaps that will inform a greater understanding of his character. I think the relationship that he had with Spock, there's been some speculation that Spock might make an appearance here on Discovery. I don't know, and frankly, I don't care. What I do care about is this opportunity that we have to learn something about Sarek, I think that will inform us as to who he is, and I think to some degree the relationship, the conflict that he had with his own son.
So do you feel like we're rehashing old Vulcan territory? I mean, we know that Vulcans struggle with logic versus emotion. You know, they either repress it or they ignore it or they struggle with it. You know, this is not new territory, if you like. So what are we learning about the human condition based on this particular portrayal of the Vulcan worldview as opposed to the human worldview and the inner conflict? Like, I don't feel like I learned anything totally new yet. We've only seen two episodes and the character's just being introduced, right? I haven't learned anything new yet about the human condition based on this portrayal of Michael Burnham. But again, because I feel like the Vulcan logic versus emotion thing is kind of old hat. They've hacked that up 20 different ways to Sunday, right? So am I missing some nuance that I have yet to recognize until you pointed out to me?
No, not necessarily. I mean, did I learn anything new about Vulcans? No, I really didn't. Will I? That remains to be seen.
Yeah, we don't know.
Right, I do feel like I learned something new about Sarek.
Yes, sure.
I think what's going to make this interesting is we're not dealing with Michael Burnham half Vulcan. We're dealing with Michael Burnham entirely human, having been raised in an environment. I mean, she's even presented to some degree. She's unique. Captain Georgiou points out the fact that she's the first human to ever attend the Vulcan Science Academy.
She's more like Worf in that regard.
Yeah, I think.
Right.
I think that there are some similarities there. And honestly, I at this point in time, I think that's something that's going to make her an interesting character. She's not Vulcan, but she is a human being that has embraced Vulcan logic and Vulcan principles. And she gives this really impassioned speech at the end of the Battle at the Binary Stars, where she talks about her childhood growing up on Vulcan. And so I think that makes her very unique. And I think it's something that is definitely informing and will continue to inform the character. I think that they'll bring this idea. And Zachary, you should be happy. I mean, I think we're going to get
I'm thrilled. There's stoicism. New Star Trek. Don't misread me. I'm having a great time. It's new Star Trek. I'm just nitpicking.
Yeah, I think we're going to get, you know, this kind of stoicism really fully embodied in a flesh and blood human being. I'm excited to see what they do with that. I said to my wife when we were sitting there watching it in its first run when it was live on CBS, how diverse, you know, this crew is. You know, this is not just a female captain, but she is an Asian female captain. And I thought that was really great. I love the fact that Star Trek has not only continued with this idea of you know, women in the captaincy, but, you know, they brought an Asian main character in. However, they killed her off. So this is not your father's Star Trek. We took a main character and we gave two episodes, really one episode, but two episodes here to really start to get to know this character. And then we killed her off. Now, I'm confident that we'll get to see Captain Georgiou again in some flashbacks, but we're going to be introduced to a new captain, and that is the captain of the Discovery, Captain Lorca. Now, I read a really interesting article in which the showrunner, Aaron Harberts, had a conversation with the Hollywood Reporter, and it gives us a really interesting glimpse into what I think might be a little bit of a snippet into what I think the future of the show might look like. He says, quote, "If Georgiou represents the absolute ideal version of a Starfleet captain, which is to say she has the moral authority given to her by Starfleet, Lorca represents the situational ethics that come into play during times of desperation and war. During times where sometimes the rules don't apply when it comes to matters of life and death. He exists in a very gray area, and he's almost a captain that could only exist in this context. And in fact, context is a very important thing for Lorca. He believes that context is what should decide actions," end quote. Zachary, that to me raises a whole other host of interesting ideas.
I guess I just don't, you know, we haven't been introduced to the character yet, right? So I don't really know what that means. I have a hunch that if you take context too strongly, you run the risk of ignoring general principles and how they apply to the context.
He could be a captain that's vilified to some degree. I mean, I'm totally speculating. He could be something more like Benjamin Sisko, or he could be something more like Maxwell. We just don't know.
Yeah.
One thing again, we do know, this is not our father's Star Trek, so
it's pure speculation. But you mentioned a minute ago, you mentioned that you were impressed with the diversity of the cast. And I don't mean to pick a fight here because I really don't have an iron in this fire in any way, shape, or form. But do you feel like, I feel like maybe that if diversity is a concern in terms of the diversity of the crew, were they risky enough in doing that? You know, as I look at the geopolitical situation here in the world today, we've got, you know, let's build a wall to keep those Mexicans out. We've got possible war with North Korea, and we've got radical Islamic terrorists, right? Those are our kind of three, you know, unholy trinity of people we like to be afraid of in this day and age. Again, kind of in irony quotes, right? Do you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah, I know exactly what you're saying, and I know where you're going.
I guess. Well, okay. So if those are where we see the hot button issues, if I were going to be really ultra on point and relevant, I would have taken a representative from each of those three groups and put them on the bridge.
We haven't even got our ship yet.
Of course not. Now, again, I'm being maybe a little unfair. We haven't seen the full crew yet. Of course, we don't know. But do you think that that's an important thing to do for Star Trek to continue to go out looking for, you know, the groups of people that we don't like to like? and find a way to bring them into the fold in our casting. Is that an important thing for Star Trek to do? It seems like your emphasis on diversity leads you to think that it is. And I guess my question then is, did they and will they go far enough in that regard if that's an important thing to do? I don't really know. Again, no iron in this fire. Really don't have an iron in this one.
Yeah, I've said before, and I'll say again, I'm not in favor of bringing characters in to check a box. We do know from at least all the reports out there that we're going to be introduced to Star Trek's first openly gay character. And I assume that we'll get that introduction next week, if not next week, the week after. I'm sure that character is a part of the Discovery crew. In fact, the actor who claims that his character is the gay character, I saw him in one of the snippets from the next episode, one of the previews into the next episode. So I'm sure that's going to happen next
and that's
week.
And that's totally in line with Star Trek's progressive increasing inclusiveness over time.
Sure, right? It is.
You know, encompassing a wider and wider set of people that could potentially in the past have been disenfranchised.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, to answer your question, I think it's important in that representation matters. And so when you look at, for instance, you know, a Middle Eastern character, a Latin American character, I think that there's definitely room. Will they do it? I don't know. It wouldn't surprise me a bit. But, you know, if they're doing it just to check a box and say, oh, look, we have a Latin American character. Oh, look, you know, I think that would be mistake.
No, I think that's an unfair characterization. I'm not saying just to do it to check a box, but I'm saying, you know, if you're looking to, if part of the goal is to be inclusive, not to check a box, that's not the right connotation.
Right, right.
I don't know. I'm not saying
that's the point you're making.
My point is that go looking for the hottest hot button issues you can find and find those people.
Yeah.
You know, not to check a box, but to make sure that you're hitting the on point, not the easy to like hot button issues, but the hottest hot button issues.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think over the course of the series, I think just the same way Deep Space Nine, for instance, pointed back to the civil rights movement of the 1960s within the character of Captain Sisko, I think the writers of Discovery will find clever ways to not just point into our present, but also point into our past, you know, through the characters and through their stories. I think that's what Star Trek does and has always done it well.
Yeah, and it's tough because when you do that, I think the phrase you used, again, kind of half-jokingly, is check a box, right? The danger is that that will be perceived as checking a box. Mm-hmm. Your token black character, your token Middle Eastern character, your token Hispanic character, right? Your token gay character, whatever. It's tough because you want to intentionally be inclusive, right, in your casting choices, right? Mm-hmm. Star Trek, you wouldn't be Star Trek if there wasn't some attempt to do that, I think, right? You would be missing the historical influence of Star Trek along these lines if you didn't do that. You'd have to be blind not to see that Star Trek has had a mission like that all along. On the other hand, you know, you'd still want to tell a good story. It still has to be good fiction. You still have to cast the right people for the roles, right? So there's a kind of just, you know, a middle ground between, you know, being as inclusive as you can, not checking a box for its own sake, still telling a good story and casting the right people for the roles. And how it all shakes out, no one's going to be happy. I think that's maybe, I don't know if I really have a point here other than, you know, not everyone will be happy with it. Because there's no perfect way to roll the dice in that regard, right? You don't have an infinite number of roles. You can't include everyone and everything. You have 6 or 7 main characters, and you've got a certain kind of story you have to tell, and you're going to try to be inclusive. And at the end of the day, you're going to end up with six or seven people you ended up with, and that's the end of the story, and leave it to the future Star Trek series to do something different. So, but again, you know, like if that's part of Star Trek's role, then why not find the hottest hot button issues and put those in? You know, I think that would be, it's an interesting point. I think if geopolitically those are the hot button areas in the world, build a wall around Mexico, keep those Islamic terrorists at bay, and let's go fire missiles at North Korea to, you know, vastly oversimplify it, then why not, you know, be inclusive in those directions if that's geopolitically where the hot button issues are?
Absolutely. And that's where we have to I don't think that's about casting the right actors. I think that's about having the right people in the writing room. And I will say that based on what I've seen so far and what I know of the writers who are working on this series, I think they do have the right people in the writing room. And I'm really excited, Zachary, again, based on what I've seen and what I've read and, you know, all the inclinations that I have going forward. I'm just really, I guess in way of final thoughts, I'm coming away from these first two episodes really encouraged and really excited about the future of Star Trek and where Discovery is going to take us.
Okay, one thing I think is interesting, and again, we can talk about particular forms of inclusiveness all we want, but I actually think that culturally things have changed. When Deep Space Nine first aired, it was a big deal. Like an African American captain, you know, of a on a Star Trek show, yeah. right? Or, you know, wow, that's innovative and new, right? We've never seen that before.
Oh, we said it right in the episode. It's about time.
Yeah, look at how much progress we've made. When Voyager started, a woman captain. Look at how much progress we've made. I feel like we've actually evolved to the point where we can just take for granted that a person of color or a woman or both can be, you know, captain of a starship, and that's not even worth commenting on because it's so obvious at this point that that's could be a thing, right? And I think that we forget how far we've actually come. The fact that that in itself is not really comment worthy. I mean, we spent the whole episode. Yes, we're mentioning it now, but we're not really commenting on it, right? We're commenting on the fact that we don't need to comment on it. I think that's an amazing commentary on how far we have actually come despite all the challenges in the world.
Well, and it all started with a passing comment. I mean, it wasn't even a main point. It was just a passing comment, you know, that I made, just a quick observation that really pointed to the fact that it's difficult for us to gauge the diversity or inclusiveness of this iteration of Star Trek based on these first two episodes.
Yeah, I mean,
we haven't even seen our ship yet, but we haven't met our captain yet.
But what we're playing now is the Me Too game. Hey, can I be included too? Can I be included? Mm-hmm. What about my group? Right. But we can take for granted that groups have a place and that, you know, people don't have to be kind of whitewashed to be captain of a starship. I think that's obviously, right? We know that now. And that got so much attention we forget how much press this really got. Yes. Way back in the early and mid 90s, mm-hmm. about these very things. And we've evolved past that. And that's amazing. Think about it.
Yeah.
You know, it's not perfect. But we don't have to explain that that's a thing that's possible to people anymore. They get it. Okay, that's awesome.
Well, Zachary, I've already shared my final thoughts. Do you have any final thoughts as we move towards the end of our podcast?
Yeah, it's hard because I want, you know, usually when I do final thoughts on Metatrex, I want to give kind of a nice sort of systematic summary of my thoughts. And I don't really have a systematic summary of my thoughts on Discovery yet. Like I said, I've only seen the first two episodes once each. And I'm too close to it to really know for sure. I was really excited about what they did with the Klingons. It's such a different portrayal of Klingons we've ever seen. We're getting backstory on the Klingons. I do think there's some not too subtle references to our current situation. You know, the fragmentation of our worldviews here in the United States, the need for a strong authority/leader figure to try to unify everyone. This, you know, quasi-racist, keep the invaders at bay notion, build a wall around the United States. And there's so much that's relevant there. And what its ultimate point is, we don't really know because we haven't seen how the stories are fleshed out. At least there's relevance. Maybe there'll be a further takeaway that we'll get down the road. Again, in terms of Michael Burnham, the character, I feel like I have yet to see anything really new about logic versus emotion, and now that we haven't already talked about ad nauseum on Metatrex and in the history of Star Trek. So I'm looking for something there to really latch onto that makes me go, yes, that's new and innovative and I can really get excited about. There, I'm not too excited, but I am definitely excited about what they're doing with the Klingons. I think T'Kuvma is a really interesting messianic figure. You know, again, I read him a little more like a Klingon cult leader than a great unifier, but you know, maybe he's both at the same time. You know, we've got the Klingon restorationist movement. I think in the Klingon worldview, it's quasi-samurai and quasi-it's nobility-based, and it's very different from us as a people, and yet they seem to have all the conflicts that we as a people have. So I really kind of just want to understand more about how the Klingon mindset works. What's the relationship between the authority figure versus these noble houses versus their sort of overall samurai culture and what that means for the struggles. I think it's interesting to see Klingons that are genuinely kind of afraid of the invaders. You know, I think of Klingons as the ones who are starting the invasion, not out of fear, but out of, you know, some sense to, you know, out of mm-hmm. honor, out of, you know, proving themselves as a warrior. I mean, these are Klingons that are more reactive than I'm used to seeing, and I haven't quite digested that. But I also think it's a truism that a lot of us react out of fear most of the time, you know, especially in a crisis. So I think there's something relatable about these Klingons that maybe we haven't seen in Star Trek before in terms of relatability. Again, in parentheses, maybe with Star Trek VI being an exception. And in fact, the spoken Klingon dialogue inside Star Trek Trek Discovery so far is more fluid than we're used to seeing in 1990s Star Trek. We're used to a very kind of punctuated Klingon dialogue, you know, that da-da-da-da kind of staccato sound. And here we get kind of a softer, more fluid, more conversational Klingon with all the same words, a lot of attention to detail there, mm-hmm. but it sounds a lot more like the conversational Klingon we got in Star Trek VI. And it's interesting that that conversational Klingon happened in the same kind of mindset, right? In Star Trek VI, the Klingons were worried about losing their Klingon identity, and we kind of see that happening here as well. And it's amazing how that affects the intonation of the dialogue, and not just the fact that they're speaking in Klingon is really interesting. Some people love it, some people hate it. I think the what's interesting to me is the cadence of speech, the way the Klingon sounds, because it sounds very different than the stronger warrior type Klingons that we saw in almost the hairband Klingons from the 90s. These are not hairband Klingons. These are skinhead Klingons, you know, to draw the alt-right analogy a little further.
Yeah. So. Well, I too really like the Klingons that we got here in Star Trek Discovery. I know that there is the the pro Discovery Klingon camp and the anti Discovery Klingon camp. I'm more pro. I think they've done some really interesting things aesthetically with the Klingons. You and I were talking about the style of weapons and, you know, the way they're very ornamental. Klingons, not so much the clean lines and that we got in Star Trek: The Next Generation and forward, but these are very different Klingons. T'Kuvma, I think, is an interesting character. I think we've killed T'Kuvma, at least presumably at the end here of the battle at the Binary Stars. I don't think we've seen the last of our Klingon cult leader. I think we'll see more Klingon cult fiction as we go forward. And as far as
we pull no punches, she's a Klingon cult leader. No punches are pulled here
No, we don't pull punches. But again, I am really interested in this Michael Burnham character. I think she's fascinating. I think that the exploration of what I believe will be, to some degree, her redemption. She's a redeemable character. She's inherently a good person. She made some bad choices, and it appears that she's going to pay a pretty heavy price for those bad choices. So I'm kind of looking forward to seeing how they redeem her character. And again, I'm just looking forward to actual Discovery coming this Sunday.
Well, the theme of redemption is if anything is a universal theme, the theme of redemption is, right? Everyone's made bad decisions and needs some redemption in some form. And, you know, I have a hunch it'll be a little too close to the reset button approach to redemption. Like, no, you know, are there actual consequences for her, or is she going to get off easy and, you know, be hunky-dory in this new ship? We don't really know. So I do think that's one of the universal themes that we can identify in her character. But and anyone who can reason her way out of a brig is okay in my book, using logic. So she's already on my good side.
I still say that was very Captain Kirk.
But Mike, breaking out of brigs with logic isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek.fm.
Previously on Trek.fm, Melodic Treks.
I really like the two Fairhaven episodes that we got. I know a lot of people are either very hot on these episodes or very cold on them. They've never bothered me. I think they're a lot of fun, and they're silly, but whatever. But one of the things that's really cool about them is we get something different in the musical field for Star Trek, with this wonderful Irish-style music.
Earl Grey.
Well, I just noticed mine deals with all naked people.
Richard!
Wow! All right.
Wait a minute. Oh, Justice Tappich, you're right.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
I just noticed that. I was like, oh.
There's nudity in each of those episodes.
Well done.
TVMA.
Warp 5.
It was a weekly thing. It was originally on Tuesdays. At some point, Trip decided to make it a nightly thing. or at least that was his idea, but then it went back to a weekly thing. I'm like, that sounds just like my life, because this is the type of thing where it's like, yeah, you get together every Tuesday, and then you gotta wait a whole week, and at some point you're like, we should be doing this every day.
To the journey!
Yeah, I mean, the way that he behaves towards B'Elanna is kind of... he gets a bit creepy there.
Well, he gets punched too, just like Joe Carey, so...
he does. B'Elanna makes a habit of punching her staff.
It's team building. It's like trust falls.
It is team building. Maybe it's like some kind of exciting club.
Yeah, I've been punched by B'Elanna Club.
I've been punched by B'Elanna, and I'm obviously now in the inner circle for engineering.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out all of these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on the iPhone, iPad, Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they are published. And please leave us a star rating and a written review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and most third-party podcast apps, and you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link as well. Well, we'd love to hear your thoughts on today's episode of MetaTreks, and there are many ways for you to share your thoughts with us. The best place to join in the larger conversation with us is in the Babel Conference, our listeners-only discussion group on Facebook. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the contact form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Just choose Message to a Trek FM Show and select MetaTreks. That will come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter at TrekFM and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. Well, Mike, speaking of contact information, when you're not placing a long-distance phone call back to Sarek, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, Zachary, you can always catch me on Facebook. That's where I'm most active. I'm in the Babel Conference from time to time. You can also catch me over on Twitter. My Twitter handle is at cmichael1701. I'm occasionally on Instagram, cmichael1701 there. And you can always read my blog about my journey to publish my novel. That's found at cmichael1701.wordpress.com. And Zachary, when you're not sensing the coming of death, where can people find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Man, I'm just a realist. What are you talking about? Well, you can find me elsewhere on Trek.fm as co-host of To the Journey, Trek FM's podcast dedicated to all things Star Trek Voyager, along with my two co-hosts over there, Suzanne Williamson and Kay Shaw. You can find me in the Babel Conference if you'd like to talk about Star Trek and philosophy with me over there. And you can always follow me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, at Zachary Fruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. Mike, I wasn't bred to sense the coming of death or to be a pessimist. I'm just a realist, man.
Oh.
Don't paint me into that corner.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to mistake you as a Kelpian.
Well, if you'd like to help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week, we invite you to become a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and many more, all available through our special patrons website, Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of time and money to produce, host, and distribute these podcasts each month. We really appreciate any support you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. We'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTreks team from around the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, the founder and publisher of Trek.fm, and the most unifying leader we know. Our executive producers, Matthew Rushing and Kenneth Tripp, Aaron Harvey, our art director, Richard Marquez, our production manager, and Brandon Shea Mutala, our Patreon manager. And we'd like to give a special thank you and a shout out to our four associate producers here on MetaTreks. We'd like to thank Patrick Devlin. You can find Patrick under the Twitter handle at MagicDrop5. Kay Shaw, my co-host over on To the Journey. You can find her under the Twitter handle at ChocoWeeble. Norman Lau, you can find Norm under the handle at Starfighter1701. And our newest associate producer, Mark Walker, who you can find in Parts Unknown, because we do not have your Twitter handle, Mark. Send us your Twitter handle, buddy.
I should say, Zachary, that all four of those wonderful people, Patrick, Kay, Norman, and Mark, share the title, The Unforgettable.
The four most unforgettable people we know, next to Tecumseh, of course. And don't don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. And check out audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Well, everyone, thanks for listening to MetaTreks, a Star Trek and philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.
Or Kelpians.
Or Kelpians. Even though they don't like to because they're afraid.